There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to another episode of the How I Quit Alcohol podcast. For first-time listeners, please be aware that not all of the conversations within this podcast are suitable for children. I'd also like to add a trigger warning that sometimes the conversations can get a little heavy. We may talk about things like sexual abuse, domestic violence, drug use, and alcohol use. And if you feel that that may trigger you, please do not tune in. Also, I'd like to add, if you are a heavy daily drinker, please seek the help of a medical practitioner before quitting alcohol. This podcast comes to you from beautiful Bundjalung country. Please kick back and enjoy. Grab yourself your favorite alcohol-free bevy. And if you haven't already, do a gal a favor. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Hi, guys. Wow, this is such a massive story that I'm sharing today. It's my friend Fenella, who lives close by to me. And it's a big story, this one, and really the places where alcohol took Fenella is pretty extreme. This episode really does highlight the intensity and the power that alcohol can have over us and just how far some people will go and how disconnected it makes us, how unwell it can make us. But on the other side of that, it's an amazing story of hope as well, that if you've been trying and trying and it's not sticking and you're trying again and it's still not sticking, do not lose hope. There is always hope for you to get well. And this story could push some buttons of some people. It could be a little triggering. Some of the conversations, we do talk about Fenella's eating disorder. We also talk about her suicidal ideology as well, and also some domestic violence accusations in there as well. So it's quite a big episode. If you're feeling a bit sensitive, probably don't tune into this one. But yeah, again, it's a story of hope and a story of change. So I hope you do enjoy. Hi, and welcome back to How I Quit Alcohol. Today in the Zoom room, I'm joined by a friend of mine. Her name's Fenella. She's got quite a phenomenal story. So buckle up. Take some deep breaths. You're going to need them, and maybe even a tissue or two. Fenella, thank you so much for coming on today. How are you?
Thanks, Danny. Awesome. Very, very grateful to be able to have a chance or a platform to share my story and hope that maybe there's someone out there that this helps.
Yeah, I'm sure your story is going to help many people. I have no doubt about that. So firstly, can you tell the audience how long you have been alcohol-free for?
I've been just over 3.5 years. So it'll be 4 years on July the 18th of this year.
Wow, that's amazing. So amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And how
I'd like to say it's blown past, but yeah.
Oh, good. I can't wait to get into that bit. And how old's your son, Freddie?
He is 2 and 3 months.
Okay. Yeah. So he's never seen mum drunk?
He has never.
And will never, hopefully.
Yeah, it's a real, real blessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us a bit about your story, Fenella. Where did you grow up? What was life like for you as a young person? Yeah,
grew up in Brisbane, and then we moved a bit to the UK for about 2 years, and then finished my high school in Sydney in the North Shore. I went to an all-girls school in the final years of high school, which was awful. I hated school. And I think moving around as well, I got a bit, like bits of it were great, but it definitely made me a little bit of an anxious teenager towards the end. You know, you sort of want to be stable.
What was it about it that made you anxious?
For me, it was that some of my education wasn't the same. Obviously, just moving from the UK to Sydney, but my maths wasn't up to Australian standard. And I was always sort of made fun of. And I became very aware that I wasn't exactly like other people. My accent was slightly different. And because I hadn't grown up with these people, especially going to an all-girls school, it was really hard to get into the clique. I think those cliques start quite young. Some of those girls have been going to the same school since year one, and coming in year six, which is the final, was just really tough. And then, but when we got to the high school part, got a little bit easier, to year seven, all of that. And then just, I think, normal teenage things. And yeah, developed a lovely eating disorder. Yeah.
Let me pull back just for a second. When you were saying, you know, feeling like you were on the outer, I guess, what does that do for the psyche of a little person when they're feeling on the outer all the time? They feel a bit different.
Oh, it's just, you feel really small yet really big. You feel like you really stick out when you don't. You either feel ignored. I'm quite tall, and I always was, especially when I was young as well, I was taller than all my friends. I had red hair, and so I have a redhead. I have just bleached the hell out of it the moment I could.
Girl, so, that's ringers, a, ringers in arms.
Yes,
I didn't know that.
And you have kept yours, and I have. Yeah, that's another. Yeah.
I do have ringer trauma though, for sure. But I've just managed to work through it.
Yeah, it really is. It's a trauma. You get picked on so badly, but like you can't say anything about it because it's not like an, you know, your culture or anything like that. And you've got to be able to just laugh it off. And after a while,
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love it now. I just own it. I just love it. I actually love it. I love that it makes me different.
But you know, it just looks gorgeous. And my sister looks gorgeous with her. She never dyed her hair. And I get moments where I'm like, oh, when I'm a bit older, I'll let it get to natural. But yeah, we'll work through that trauma.
Oh, maybe we should talk more. Okay, so I really love what you said. You felt small, but you also felt really big.
Oh,
that just got me too, because that feeling big part, I'm assuming, is because you felt so obviously on the outer. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And it was tough. Mm-hmm. But then there was also good parts. I think that it helped me learn to become quite social or even work out social situations. I had to learn to adapt, to talk to different people, how difficult it was to integrate into places. So I think that's kind of helped me, because I moved places quite a bit. I haven't always lived in Australia now, so...
Mm-hmm. And then you said that you developed, you sort of flippantly said, oh, I'm developing eating disorder. Nothing, there's no flippancy here in this podcast. Right, I'm going in. So let's talk about that. So how did that look for you, the eating disorder?
It was very complicated because, I don't know, I think nowadays, I think they talk about it a lot more at school, especially in girls' schools. When I was growing up, it was sort of spoken about, but it was always like, oh, but there's a token anorexia or the token bulimic in that year. And we already had one, so I didn't really think that it was going to be me. And I certainly didn't set out to become anorexic. It wasn't like my goal. But we had a German exchange student come and stay with us, and my parents thought it would be wonderful. And you know, looking at it from now being a parent, you do see that there could have been a benefit. But I took it as competition, and I was insanely jealous of her. This girl came in and she was already better at English than me. It was so embarrassing. Everyone's just like, isn't she your German exchange student, Fenella? And I was like, oh my god. So I worked out that I couldn't outdo her in a lot of subjects, and I certainly couldn't outdo the attention that my parents were giving her. So I thought I could outdo her and become skinnier. And yeah, started off just with a normal sort of wary diets, and but you're young and you don't really know what you're doing. You don't understand what works and what doesn't. And I definitely ballooned because I didn't work out that it's actually cutting down on certain things. And within about a year, she left. And about 6 months after that, I was, the school rang my parents. And my mum was so, she was mortified because she didn't know, because I'd started hiding it. It was also winter by the time I was fully, you know, pencil thin. And my mum spoke to me and said, you know, what was going on. I'd said, you know, I'd stopped eating and everything. And then I just started eating again. It was never addressed.
Can I ask a question? Sorry, I have to ask, how did the school notice but not mum?
So apparently one of my friends had gone up and said, I'm worried about Fenella. I don't know whether it was, whether she actually was worried or was just like trying to get me into trouble or something, because I feel like it was just very, I didn't expect her to go up and do that. And I vaguely know who it was, but anyway, they didn't know. I was pretty good at hiding it, but also I don't think they noticed. You know, I'd never had a problem with food before that. I wasn't a picky eater. I'd shown sort of no interest before in worrying about food. And I guess I just went unnoticed and it was easy.
So tell me, so after the German exchange student had gone home, yet you still carried on.
Oh, yeah.
So obviously something's switched in your brain where it wasn't about her anymore. What was it about?
I was able to manage those anxious feelings. I no longer had to feel anything. You know, that anxiety of going to school, dealing with friend group dynamics, always feeling a little bit on the outside anyway. And all of that started to go. And now I understand that I was numbing it because you're so damn hungry.
I was going to say, how does it numb it? Is it that you're so hungry that it takes?
Well, you're so focused. Your body becomes so focused and your mind, becomes so focused on calculating what you have eaten, what you can do to stop feeling hungry. And there's no space at all in your mind to feel anything else.
Wow. And now I understand a bit more, because I've always kind of wondered, what is it? Like, how does it numb the pain? But that makes sense. So it's a distraction, just like anything else where we distract ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's understanding that now, because I had two sort of bouts of it, two flare-ups, and both of those are the same reason. And a form of control, certainly. You know, I couldn't control, obviously, circumstances around me. Couldn't control what was happening, but I could control this, and I felt I had a bit of power that all belonged to me.
Did you feel powerless before? Was there a part in your childhood where you felt powerless?
No, but I certainly enjoyed having what this power gave me, what the eating disorder gave me.
I'm going to ask this question, you don't have to answer, but me and my thinking brain, even just from a therapy standpoint, when I'm hearing you say that you were jealous of the exchange student, usually indicates that there was already a wound there. Are you able to
that at all? I've always wanted my parents' attention. I've never really gone much into where that sort of stemmed from. You know, I do know that my mum had to obviously work a lot. She was always working. We were with a nanny. But I've always, from a young age, I just remember my sister having a birthday party and I was so jealous. And I still remember, it's so weird. I must have been about 5. And it's this weird memory of getting up and being like, today's the day. Today's the day. It's all about her. And I was like, how could I make it about me? And it's so weird. I just remember that feeling. Obviously, I wasn't saying that at 5.
Yeah.
And I remember putting on this tutu and I remember sort of watching from a distance of her getting all this love and attention.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's incredible. and very vulnerable of you too, and so honest. But right, so there was also something, so it's predated even that perhaps.
Yeah.
So there was something in you where you felt like you weren't getting as much, or there was,
so
there's a little wound there. That's really interesting. Okay. All right. So fast forward. So the school's called your mum. Your mum's talked to you about it. Where do we go from there? What happened?
Remember, my mum spoke to me on a Saturday morning, and that Saturday night, I gave myself a huge piece of dessert, and I gave myself the permission to eat again. And I definitely binged. I suddenly was able to eat a lot of foods that I'd never allowed myself to eat. So my weight didn't suddenly put on, but maybe after 4 or 5 months, I put on weight and I was back to being normal. But it was such a shock to my system visually, if that makes sense. And, you know, you no longer fit those clothes and you suddenly realize, ooh. And then I also suddenly realized that I could manipulate my body. And that's when the diet really started. And I remember I was away on holiday and I wanted to eat things, but I was like, oh no, you know, that's not good for you. And you sort of go back, not as bad as it was, obviously, but you become very wary of what you eat. But back then, 2009, it was like all the girls were doing it and it was just fitted in and I just let it be. And then about 3 years later, it hit again when I got my dream job. And it happened quite suddenly. And I was in hospital for 6 weeks after that.
What happened?
So I started working as a flight attendant and it was my absolute dream job. That's all I'd ever wanted to do was become a flight attendant and then become a mum. Just didn't have the plan in between the anorexia and alcoholism. Anyway, so obviously training and everything was great. And I remember this flight attendant saying, careful of your weight when you start working with the airline, you'll balloon a bit. When they all made jokes about the uniform being adjusted for certain girls, and I was like, I will not be one of those. And I really like kicked in. And again, that power of controlling what I was eating was showing that my outside circumstances were not in order. But that was mine. It became like my friend. Maybe like a pet. And I always had this like comforter with me. And I was nervous, you know, going out, working on an aircraft, being with hundreds of thousands of passengers a week and being responsible for their safety and all of that sort of thing. It was scary, but it was okay because I had my pet with me. I suppose it became like this emotional support disease.
Yeah, wow. Mm-hmm.
It was so strange and it hit a lot. But I had to resign. I got quite sick towards the end. I had a heart issue. I was on an aircraft doing a red eye from Darwin to Melbourne. And I suddenly felt like really quite sick. And I then fainted basically just down the aisle and I smacked my face on one of the armrests. And apparently I was out for about 2 minutes. They managed to land, it was quite close for some reason to Adelaide. I think we were going to Adelaide, stop quickly, refuel, and then up to Melbourne. So I was offloaded in Adelaide and they were like, oh, you know, your heart rhythm's all weird. Your blood pressure's incredibly low. They're like, are you a marathon runner? You know, you're quite thin. And I was like, oh, no, but, you know, this is just my natural body. And my face was so bruised and cut up, so I couldn't go to work for a while. But I realized that I didn't have the energy to continue doing my dream job. And I always wonder, I was like, would I still be doing it? And I always say when people ask, oh, why did you like resign? And I was like, oh, well, it wasn't what I thought it was. And it certainly wasn't. It wasn't like flying in the 1960s and you get these wonderful perks and all that sort of thing. But it's still, I did love it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I resigned from that. I went back home to live with my parents while I looked for a job. And my eating became awful. I was terrified of water. And my parents tried again, just please eat, please eat. And I couldn't. And I was monitored and I just couldn't.
Why were you scared of water?
If somebody else served it to me. If I served myself the water, it was okay. But if somebody else served me the water, I didn't know whether it was somebody had put something in it.
Also, was it quite paranoid?
Yeah, that's it. I was paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. And I had my safe foods, which was, yeah, I get nervous about talking sometimes about an eating disorder because when I was in it, I would listen to things. Obviously, we didn't have podcasts, but like I would listen to YouTubes and hear what they ate and compare it to how my eating disorder is and what my safe foods are. So I get nervous about ever saying what they were or tactics that I did.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think it's good to be sensitive to that too. And perhaps we won't list those what they are, but we know that you had certain foods that you thought were safe. Yeah, that's great. Okay.
So I was taken to a great therapist, Stephen Toys, who's done a lot of research and heads up one of the eating disorder clinics in Sydney area, sort of Surrey Hills, I think, area. Anyway, I was there for 6 weeks. I learned a lot of how to become a better anorexic and a better bulimic in certain senses there, but I chose not to. I really wanted to get out. But some of that information has stayed in my mind and I have to be wary.
What do you mean by that? A better anorexic and a better bulimic, like hiding it or?
Hiding it. Yeah, I'd just say hiding it and tactics for manipulation.
Wow, it's pretty, wow. Full on. I have to ask this question as well. I hope this doesn't offend you at all. No. But was there any part of you that there was that thing about jealousy and attention when you were having the flare up with the eating disorder? You obviously would have been getting a lot of attention from mum, from parents, from family, whoever. Was that part of it as well, the fact that you were getting attention?
Yeah, I've been asked this a few times and they thought it was as well. But by then, you do not want attention. You do not want anyone to look at you, talk to you. The last thing, if I could, I would have like gone and got myself a shack somewhere so far away from my parents, so far away from anyone. It's really strange because you crave the attention, yet you start to get it, but it's not the attention you want. Because what you wanted really was to be hugged. And that's how I feel. Like I wanted to be, sounds so, I am loved. My parents do love me, but I felt like I just wanted to be loved. And you get such negative attention from the eating disorder because they're scared. And a lot of it comes out as quite tough. And that's the last thing you want.
Well, yeah, I can certainly understand how that would happen. And it's true, isn't it? And I think when any of us have any kind of coping mechanism that's kicked in, most of the time what we're actually craving is love.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a really powerful thing to say. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so when comes the alcohol? So you, and also I just want to say that you weren't drinking really.
No, God, no. Oh, so when all my friends would go, I was terrified of alcohol.
Why were you terrified of alcohol?
Back when I was quite young, I have a small memory of my dad, my biological dad, coming home and he had been out with some friends and he was quite drunk. And I remember him picking me up and squeezing me and it really hurt. And I was scared because he wasn't acting or being like dad. Like, and I was really scared. And then I went and saw him like an hour later and he was being violently ill. And I was so terrified. I was like, what is this? And then ever since then, I hated alcohol. I hated the way that it changed people. I hated that they weren't the person that I was with. And it gave me this weird feeling, like, you know, when people are terrified of spiders, it was the same feeling. So I never really touched it at all when, you know, you're 16 and all of that, because I was terrified. And then obviously with the eating disorder, I was like, why on earth would you drink calories? So I didn't touch that. But come 2012, I had a few drinks. Never really liked the taste of alcohol. It was, you know, I would mix it terribly with like, it'd be a tiny bit of vodka and like huge amounts of like Diet Coke or something like that, anything to take away the taste. But I certainly noticed that it started to give me a feeling that I had with my eating disorder, where things felt a little bit calmer, a little bit blocked out. My mind felt more peaceful. And yeah, it started with that. And it gave me confidence, that I never thought that I had. But looking back, I don't think I was unconfident. I just, your mind was just going and you're like, oh my God, they don't like me. But when you had like a drink, you're like, I don't care whether you like me or not.
So true, isn't it? It's like,
And that
there's
was
like
nice.
one part of it's like, oh my God, they don't like me, they hate me. And then a few drinks, you're like, who gives a fuck anyway?
And it's a great feeling. And
Oh.
you're like, yes, my confidence is skyrocketing. And it's like, yeah, you're just have no care in the world.
Until the next day.
Oof.
Okay, so all right, so by this stage now, the eating disorders, you kind of got over that, or you're kind of on your way to getting over
Yeah, I
that?
would say it was pretty good. I moved to Switzerland to be with a guy that I'd met in New York on travels with a friend who had didn't speak any English, but I was like, he's the love of my life. I'm going to move there. So just packed up my stuff and I moved to Switzerland. We lived in Bern. I didn't know a word of German, Italian, or French, but I taught myself Albanian, which was
As you do.
I know
Makes
my
sense.
parents are like, oh, vanilla white French. Like, and I was like, no. But I was in love. And it also showed like how headstrong I am. Like, once I decide that that is what I am doing, nothing can get in the way. And I thought I just didn't have the brain to learn a language, but if love is involved. Anyway, so we moved to Europe and living there, people drank not heavily, but they drank quite early. I saw, especially when we were in Croatia, some of the family would start the day with like grappa, a shot of grappa and a dark black coffee, and then they wouldn't eat anything. I didn't start like that, but I at the beginning, but I saw that that's what you could do, and you were functioning fine, and it seemed to be an acceptable part of society. But in Switzerland, I didn't have any real friends. Again, I was just my partner, so I was at home in our apartment playing a little housewife, and I would start drinking during the day. Started with Baileys, but I was making a Baileys milkshake, and then started with wine. Again, it was quite acceptable. Maybe probably not the Baileys milkshake, but having wine at lunch was quite acceptable. And I just noticed the day went faster, a lot more fun, and I didn't really see the warning signs that I certainly wasn't drinking because, well, I wasn't drinking because that we were out with friends or we were drinking because somebody else was drinking. I was drinking alone already. And I was sneaking it. We would go and stay with his family. They didn't speak a word of English either. So I'd fill my makeup bottles with vodka and I would drink that, and it would take away the anxiety of being with people who didn't speak English. And then I was able to speak Albanian easier and just get through the day. And that was literally 6 months before that. I didn't touch a drop of alcohol. So I went full into like drinking alcohol very observedly. And
Wow.
it's, yeah.
How old were you at this stage?
24.
24. Wow. Okay. So you're all in, your balls and all in there, just going for it. Yeah. And really great to also, I just want to highlight the fact that, again, that you've found something, a way to take away the anxiety. Yeah. And so really important for people listening that asking yourself those questions, is there a behavior that you do that you're doing to take away anxiety or to mask something that's actually going on? Like, if I was to say to you, Fenella, clearly the alcohol was not just taking away the anxiety, it was masking feelings of what? What was it masking for you, do you think?
I think it was masking feeling out of place.
And there it is. That's that same feeling out of place when you were younger.
I've always felt like, and they say in AA, you know, you're just putting a square peg into a round hole. And a lot of people in AA relate to the fact that they've always felt like that through life. And that was also so amazing to hear in the rooms because I thought that I was just freaked and just that was going to be my life. And but there were other people who felt like that. So,
Yeah, that's so true. Oftentimes, particularly if I'm working with someone, either in the challenges or one-on-one, it's like finding that core wound and finding what it is that's, it might be something that happened in childhood, but once we peel away the layers, we realize, oh, that was probably what was driving the alcohol use or what was driving the anxiety. And it's pretty amazing, isn't it, when we see, wow, that was something that happened to me when I was small, yet it was still kind of controlling me. And sometimes often still is. We still have to. Just because we've taken the alcohol out doesn't mean that that core wound goes away. We still have to work on that, holding ourselves through that wound.
And that.
Amazing. Yeah. Let's talk about how it
So
evolved.
yeah, so again, but I wasn't craving alcohol, and I would go through 3 or 4 days, maybe even a month of not touching alcohol. But there would be certain times where I would. And then we moved to Singapore. The partner that I was with got a PhD in Singapore, and my parents were obviously living there. So we stayed with them for a bit and yeah, sort of settled into Singapore life. Again, I felt very outsider. Singapore was difficult. I wasn't allowed to work because I didn't have a degree. I was a flight attendant, so I'd never finished any of my university, and being in like a expat and everything. So it was hard to find anything to do. I was very reliant on my partner. And I wanted to go out. I wanted to party. It seemed to be what everybody was doing my age, but I was nervous. And again, so I'd start drinking to go out, but it seemed like everyone normal. I was drinking just like everybody else. And I did that for about a year. And then I did manage to get a job. And again, those huge nerves and anxiety crept up. And I worked out, well, you know what? We'll get rid of all of that. If I drink like the men in Croatia, I have a black coffee and a shot of, we only had limoncello. So I had a shot of limoncello. And I did that for about 3 weeks. The shot didn't give me enough, so it went up to putting some in my drink bottle, carry me through the day to keep at that high. And then people started to notice that when I did have a glass of wine or two, I would like fall over. And they were like, how is that possible? She's only had like 1 or 2 glasses of wine. And it's like, because I was lit the whole day, and these 1 or 2 glasses just pushed me over the edge. And I broke up with my partner. He was very traditional, and having a drunk girlfriend the way I was wasn't going to work. And also, I was putting him through hell. He really did care, but I was a liability to him because he was just so terrified of me.
How was the alcohol looking? So were you that drunk all the time? That must have obviously been a problem if he's noticing it and.
It was more sort of, I wouldn't really drink much during the week, but like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I would go out with friends. And but because I always had a little bit of alcohol in my system, so by now, sorry, I would binge drink, I suppose, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, but during the week I would be okay on having my 3 or 4 shots of vodka just to get through the day. And then you'd have those 3 or 4 shots of vodka on a Friday, plus some extra drinks that you started, and then you were just passing out quite early in the night. And also, I had started to be a bit wary of my eating because I knew how many calories alcohol in has, and you get that puffy face from alcohol. So I was quite worried about that. So I'd really tapered down on my eating. And plus, I also worked out you could get drunk faster if you didn't eat, save a bit of money there. So that it became a recipe for blech. So I broke up with the partner, and now I met my now partner. And I was sort of trying to now get my drinking under control. I remember, I think it was about a week after I met Joe, that I was on the bus to work, and I was like, am I an alcoholic?
What got you thinking that?
Because I had this little hit flask of vodka in my bag. And I'd been doing this for quite some time, and well, about 2 years. And I don't know exactly what had sparked it. I suppose, you know, being in AA and stuff, I certainly think it was a spiritual moment where I was like, my drinking's not normal. This is not normal. I don't feel normal. I feel like my life is really out of control now, and I can't stop.
And was that still just the 3 shots a day, or had it increased by this point?
It increased now to a hip flask just to get through the day, mostly to get rid of those shakes.
Oh, so you're eating the shakes.
I was getting shakes. I wasn't like really underweight, but I wasn't a healthy weight. And I was also terrified of feeling hungover. And I knew that if I just kept in this constant state of being slightly drunk, I wouldn't feel that hungover feeling.
Wow. Oh,
So,
full on. So you're really kind of in the cycle now.
So now I'm 26. Sounds
At
like I've
26.
been drinking since I was like 13. It's like just 2 years, 2, 3 years. Yeah. So, and by now, I became aware. So I tried to control it. I thought that if I only drank wine, I didn't ever really liked beer, but I tried that. If I only could drink beer. But the thing is, with Singapore, alcohol is unbelievably expensive. They have a huge tax on it. So the cheapest bottle of wine you can get, and this stuff tastes like nail polish remover, is like $20. I chose the most expensive country in the world to become an alcoholic. And I worked out percentage wise and all the sort of the maths and stuff like that. And it was cheaper if I actually just bought a bottle of vodka. But I mean, no alcoholic has ever been like, well, I'll just have three or four of these and this will get me through the week. And I would neck that whole bottle. And I was like, damn. And money then started to become a problem. And I became a lot more sneakier. I didn't ever steal money, but I certainly stole alcohol from friends' places. And the shakes were getting a lot worse. The passing out was getting a lot worse. And then my first episode in hospital was I was found passed out in a public toilet at 8:30 in the morning, because I had woken up after a party with some friends and drunk half a bottle of tequila and then decided I was going to go do some food shopping. I had my little dog with me and, I was wheeled out. I was shaking so terribly when I did wake up in hospital, and they knew about a previous heart issue that was obviously brought on by being unbelievably low weight. So they put it down to something along those lines. I'm not sure why nobody ever brought up alcohol, like from the doctor's perspective. I don't know whether they ever did my blood alcohol, which is different because in Australia, I think that's one of the first things they do. In Singapore, they didn't. They certainly didn't rehydrate me or anything like that. So I was so thirsty and I was shaking uncontrollably. I knew why I had passed out. It was much easier to tell people as well and go along with those lines. My partner became very worried. His brother became very worried, more sort of, you know, protecting his little brother. Like, I don't think this girl's right in the head. It's time you leave her. And we've been together for about a year. And then he went away for work and I was just left in Singapore. By now, my parents had retired and moved back to Australia. So I was alone in Singapore. I had some money that Joe was giving me. He gave me an apartment and I would drink, pass out, wake up, drink, pass out, wake up.
Was Joe aware that you were drinking, passing out?
Yeah. I don't think anybody really knew what to do. You know, it was terrifying. Nobody's, when you see someone in full addiction like that, it's, from somebody who had been completely fine like 4 years ago to doing this. And I hid it towards the end, not very well, but I hid it and I would hide obviously bottles. Remember bottles of water being full of vodka and drawers just full of bottles. But we had a really good garbage system in Singapore. It was in the house. It was one of those chutes. So that was pretty easy. Just check it in, never have to see it again. You don't know which apartment it came from. So it's pretty easy to dispose of things. Weirdly, towards the end, I got even too lazy to do that. And it was like, yeah. So
maybe
I remember
you wanted to be caught.
I know. That's what I think. I certainly wanted the obsession to stop. It's so tiring. The calculating of how am I going to get such alcohol? How am I going to get through today? Your mind is so full of just that.
Wow. Did Joe ever try and get rid of the alcohol from the house?
Yeah. The first attempt was locking it in a suitcase. And I couldn't obviously break the suitcase, the lock, or no, I think it was one of those code things, but I cut it open. It was just one of his suitcases has a big old slash, and I just pulled it out. But I was alone a lot by now, so I was drinking. And I would take myself to hospital. I took myself twice.
Why?
I knew I needed to do something, but I would make it out with something else. I was craving attention. I was craving, but like attention for help. I really wanted to stop, again, the obsession. I didn't want to stop the drinking, just the obsession. So I did that a few times. And then, Yeah, by now I'd lost all my friends. People really didn't want to hang out with you. And, you know, they were
Why?
sick. I was stealing their alcohol. And I became messy. I was passing out, blacking out completely, wetting myself, and being unable to be, anyone could wake me up. I had to be taken by ambulance to hospital, and I woke up like a day later. And this happened like 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, that's no fun.
No. just really a party pooper.
I just want to check in with you right now. Are you doing okay? Because we're bringing up some pretty big stuff. So you're okay?
Yeah, no, it's I don't know. For me, it's a great reminder of just how bad it is. And it can just be just as bad if you pick up another drink like that. Because sometimes you catch yourself, especially when you see certain photos or something like that, romanticizing the past of drinking. Mm-hmm. But it was never romantic. No, and now listening to what I'm saying, from the get-go, there was no romance. Yeah, so now Joe has come back to Singapore and has said, you're going to Sydney and we are going to get you talking to a therapist and we're going to get you into a rehab. And it was really scary to hear that. I mean, I'd only heard of rehabs in movies and thought you had to be on heroin or, you know, you've got to be like, yeah, I just knew that it wasn't a place I wanted to end up. So we came back to Sydney. Joe took me to a therapist who wrote me a referral and said that they'll be able to take you to Wesley. And we got home that evening and Joe was going to go see a friend. Or no, he went and saw a friend about 4 o'clock. And I was going to stay home because they were going out for drinks. And we thought it was a bit weird for me to go out, go into rehab in a week or so and go meet them for drinks. And I got mad. I got really mad that Joe would leave me. I was like, how dare he think that he can go see a friend? I've just been told I'm going to rehab. He should be here on his knees, like hugging me and, you know, just treating me like this powder puff. And so I went out and I bought a bottle of vodka. And I drank the whole thing and I sent some really horrible messages to him saying, how could you do this, blah, blah, blah. So he came home and we got into a big old fight and I don't really have much memory, but it was loud and the next door neighbors from where we were staying in Sydney called the police. In Singapore, that had happened before in arguments, but the police don't really do anything in Singapore. They tend to see expats and they're like, ugh, it's a little bit of a gray area. Let's just leave you to implode your own lives. But here in Australia, they take that stuff seriously. And I had a huge black eye because I'd fallen down on some stairs before we'd left. And I was very bruised. Like all of us alcoholics can, you know, you got bruises in the weirdest places and you're so malnourished that they last and they look nasty. So the police turned up and they must have asked me about the black eye. And I mean, I haven't read the transcript, but it went along the lines of, I said that that black eye was given to me by Joe. And I said something that he was mad that I couldn't, and this is so not Joe. And I don't know where I came up with, oh, it's just cringe just thinking about it. But I'd said that he was mad at me because I couldn't give him a child. And it was the most random thing. Joe didn't want a child. He just wanted me to get sober. There was nothing. We'd ever even talked about having kids. And I'd made this elaborate. And there's like bits of just remembering bits come in now. And then it sort of goes when I've got nothing. And I woke up in hospital. And there was a social worker there. And she said, I said, can I have my phone? And she said, no. I said, I would love to, where am I? And they're like, well, you're in hospital. The police have taken you here. I had a handcuff on the bed. And this was the first circumstance, or the first real reality had caught up with me. Before all of this, I'd gotten away with so much. And I put a lot down to being in Singapore and living a very sheltered life. But now I was out in the real world. Back in Australia, you had real police. Not to say they don't have that in Singapore, but like real consequences for me. And they said, no, you can't contact Joe. He's been arrested. And yeah, I'm here to help you through the domestic violence. And I was like, what? And I was like, thinking in my mind, what have I done? Shit, how do I get out of this? Can I call my parents? Like, you just want to take it all back. And you're like, no, it was just like, I just wanted some attention. I just didn't want him to go out for a drink. And still the, still the reality hadn't hit me, because they'd started to give me diazepam. So it's taken up a little bit of the, oh my God. I was like, shit, what am I going to do now? And I told the social worker, I was like, I lied. And she's like, no, no, it's okay. Like, no one's here. And I'm like, no, I really did lie. And they're looking at me like, uh-huh. I was like, no. And I was like, shit, like, I can't get away with lie.
And you've got the black eye. So they're obviously
the black
thinking,
eye. I'm covered in bruises. I'm obviously very, still quite drunk, but high alcohol. And I mean, it's all, and it's, I'm ticking all the boxes. So the social worker had said something about a detox. And I was like, that sounds right up my street. So went to Herbert Street, which is in St. Leonard's. And if anyone's been to Herbert Street knows that that is not a fun place. It is like the rehabs from the 1960s, maybe a bit nicer. But I'm turning up in just a T-shirt and underwear. I have nothing. I have no phone. I have no wallet. I have nothing. So they give me some clothes from what I called the hobo box, but it was just bits and pieces that were left from other people, and I don't even think it was washed. And I had to get underwear out of there. And we had these I had to get nasty pajamas, and we all wore sort of like these in-house pajamas, and you have this like little room and just a bed, and you detox there for 7 days. And for the first time, I felt safe. I felt like my needs, and it sounds really weird, were all being met. I felt like somebody cared. I didn't feel scared. I've always trusted doctors. I've never had a problem with them, and I've always felt the safest with them, strangely. And they felt like everything was going to be okay. So I needed to stay there for 7 days, which worked out timing-wise great, because I then had to appear in court and then go to rehab. So after my 7 days stay in there, 7 days detox, this is the longest I've been sober in like 3 years. And I leave and I go to Manly Court and I stand up and I tell the judge that I lied. This is the first time I've seen Joe. And Joe tells me after, because we weren't obviously allowed to see each other during that or everything, but sorry, before that, the judge tells me, and Joe, you two are to stay away from each other. And I'm just thinking, my God, I've lost, like, I love this man. And he unfortunately couldn't go back to work. He got stuck in Australia. He worked at the time over in Africa. He had to tell his boss why, because I was arrested for domestic violence. All of that. Anyway, so he stood up, he told each other, stay away from each other. You obviously, we weren't allowed to live together, but that was going to be okay because Joe was going back to Africa and I was going to rehab. That's what I thought in my head. And I saw Joe after, and he looked so defeated, but he still kissed me and hugged me. He said, just please get sober. He's like, I just want Vanilla back. And oh, makes me want to cry, because it's just like, you think like, God, dude, I put you in jail for going out to having 2-3 drinks with a friend. You didn't even go for a bender or something, or, you know, and you still want to be with me? I'm like, what the, why? Mm-hmm. But it did give me hope and it gave me strength to do the next part, which was go to rehab. And you turn up there, and many of you know it's a mixed emotion. But again, I felt safe. I was like, finally, I'm in somewhere where we can get this all better. And I didn't really understand alcoholism, so I really thought that they would just prescribe a pill or just give me a few 4 weeks, and then boom, bam, you're okay, you're set. I mean, I did 6 weeks in an inpatient ward with anorexia, and I left, and you know, the thoughts were still there, but I didn't act on any of them. I thought it would be a very similar experience. And prior to that, I'd tried naltrexone, which is meant to be a blocker for alcohol cravings, and anti-abuse. And I really thought that they would help. This was before rehabs and everything. And I can advise you, do not drink on any of those. I got very, very ill. Anyway, so we're in rehab and I'm feeling good. I'm feeling like, okay, we can look at your alcoholism like you're allergic to peanuts. You just don't touch them. People who are allergic to the sorts of things. My sister has allergies to gluten. She just doesn't touch bread. Cool. Let's go through therapy sessions. We talk about coping mechanisms. And 4 weeks later, I'm like, okay, cool. Let's get on with life. But they're like, you need to go to AA. And I was like, oh, that's such a weird place. Because I'd been to one AA meeting in Singapore. And I was like, it's freaky. They have this blue book that they all talk about and they all look normal. I remember coming back and telling my dad, I was just like, they are like businessmen and women. And they're sitting there and they're talking about this big book and a God. And I was like, it's so weird. Like, I don't want to be involved in that sort of thing. So I went into AA with a prejudice against it, and I really for some reason didn't want to accept that that was what I had to do. But I did the 90 meetings in 90 days, and I got myself a sponsor, and then on the 90th day I planned my experiment. And no. I had a friend, this is after the rehab, this is, you know, Joe's sort of feeling a lot more stronger, I suppose. Like I certainly think my parents are. And I see a friend from Singapore, and he's a wealthy friend, and I know he's in Sydney, and we meet up, and I know that if I'm going to break my sobriety, I'm going to do it with class. And we went to an expensive restaurant and I ordered the most expensive drink I could find. And I remember taking that one sip, and now I don't really sort of remember, but I do remember that I couldn't stop. And I woke up a day or so later with about loads of missed calls from Joe. My parents obviously they didn't even want me to go see this friend, but I was like, reassured them, it's fine. It's fine. So they're terrified. I then tried to ring a detox center and I was like, can I come in today? You know, I didn't want to go home and face the fact that I'd broken my sobriety and stuff like that. But no one's just like, you can't just do that. And the reality again hit me that I need to go back and face my parents. You know, I was lucky the first time that I got into Herbert Street when I did. I didn't have to wait for a detox. It took me an hour or so later, but that wasn't going to work this time. So I had to go back to my parents. And that's the first time that I tried to end my life. I had threatened suicide a lot before, and none of it really went through. Part of me is, I think deep down, I really didn't want to end the life. I wanted to end the alcoholic life. I wanted to just kill that and the guilt and the shame. Because I swear the moment you go to one or two AA meetings, that seed, however small, has been planted, and your drinking will never be the same. And all of the things that I had been listening to in meetings all came back, and I was like, shit, I really am an alcoholic. Like, you can't stop. And I wanted to go back. I wanted to take it all back as fast as possible and just go back to when I had 89 days and just be white knuckling it, but not in this guilt and shame that I was in right now. So now I've got to start on one.
Can I ask a question, Fenella? What were you thinking? Like, why were you just thinking the experiment, I'll just be able to have one? Or what was the rationale that was going on?
I thought that I would be able to have three or four, but I thought now that I understood what alcohol was, I would be able to drink responsibly.
Because it's common. Like, I hear it so much.
I know. That's the thing. I thought it was so common. How could I be a common person? You always think that you're better. And it's
I hear it so much. And not necessarily, it doesn't even have to be someone that's been to your degree of drinking. It can be someone that's just a binge drinker and, you know, that got pretty bad. And then they thought, I'll just try just what, you know, and it never works out. I'm sorry to fucking say this, people. It very rarely works out.
Yeah.
Maybe the odd thing. I met a guy the other day at a yoga, at a workshop with Mark Purser, and the guy was saying to me, he goes, oh, I managed to be able to moderate. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. He said, yeah, but alcohol wasn't really my addiction. It was porn. And I was like, okay. Well, like if you just started watching porn,
exactly.
You probably couldn't moderate that. So it wasn't really
the vice versa type. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Go on. So, oh my God, devastating. Yeah. But you've got to go and through these things to figure it out too, don't you?
Absolutely. And you know, now I know, and it's cemented.
Yeah. And now you know. That's right.
Now I know. But at the time, I still didn't. And but I thought that, okay, we'll clean, start going to meetings. But now I started sneaking drinks again, and I was keeping alcohol, but I was doing what is like the proper white knuckling it. I would maybe get up a month or so, and then I would drink. I'd get up 2 months, and then I would drink. And then we got to Christmas, and I was meeting Joe. I hadn't seen Joe since the whole court thing, which happened in April. And he knew that I'd relapsed and I was becoming a chronic relapser, but I'd had about a month or so sobriety up. So we were meeting in Singapore, and now I'm going almost back to the scene of the crime, of one of my crimes, and facing a lot of people who, when they saw me leave Singapore, were like, good God, how is that woman still alive? So I was coming back, and I was coming back with a lot of resentment at these people, and I really wanted to show them that I had my life together, which I did not, and I was certainly not humble. I was coming back with, my ego was huge, and I was mad, and I was fearful, and I really wanted to prove to them that I was better. So I was back in the old drinking areas, and I remember sitting at the bars and being like, damn you people being able to drink. And I started sneaking again alcohol. And then Christmas Day hit, and I told Joe I went to, and here's a very weird story coming up. I told Joe I'd gone to an AA meeting. I didn't. I went and got a bottle of wine. I didn't have any more money for another bottle of wine. So I went to a hotel in Singapore, and I said I was coming there for their Christmas brunch. Could I go into a hotel room, and just dry my hair? And they said, okay. So they gave me a room key. I went into that room, I drank the minibar, and I left. And then I went back, saw Joe, got ready for lunch, and now I'm completely blacked out. I don't really remember anything. I know that he hadn't ordered me the free flow champagne. Everyone else had it. And I woke up about 12 hours later in a straitjacket in Singapore. And my first thought was, again, I was so comfortable. Like, I'm really comfy. Like, they sort of like wrap your arms, like, I suppose maybe what a baby feels like, swaddled. Like, I had one across my stomach and one across my arm. One across my shoulder. And it was sort of wrapped up like a burrito. I was like, what the hell? Okay, this is bad. Like, what have you done now? But again, in Singapore, I was thinking I was getting away with so much. Joe didn't want to pick me up from the hospital. I had ripped my clothes, so I had no clothes to wear, but I had the hospital, they give you like this weird like pink nightie.
But what had you done to get you into a hospital with a straitjacket, or do you just don't know?
I don't really know, but I'm guessing it's along the lines of, you should have seen how shredded my clothes were. And it's
how
not
do you
from
shred your clothes?
I don't know. And it was such a nice dress, and I remember being so excited to wear it. I'm guessing at just from memories of things that I've done in the past, I must have been really, really drunk. Joe got mad at me. I then decided that I was going to rip my clothes off like some sort of primal animal on the side of the road.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Joe obviously wasn't going to pick me up. So I checked myself out. Well, the best I could check myself out, I'll be like, I'll be back to pay this bill. Bye-bye. So I left and went home in the nightie. And was like, oh, I think I need to go back to Australia. I need to go back to my AA. We're going to sort some things out. But, Joe, there's hope, because I've landed a job in Sydney
What was the job?
with Flight Centre. And I started training, 2 days into training, I was found unresponsive in a hotel room. And they had apparently tried to sort of do those chest compressions because I woke up in hospital and, oh my good God, my chest. Like, I was like, what? I felt like it was such a strong pain. It was like, I can't even like explain it, like whatever that part of you, the chest is.
The
And
sternum, yeah.
sternum,
But
oh.
why? How?
I'd drunk two goon sacks, or because I'd worked out as well. I was like, why am I buying bottles? You can buy like a sack of wine for like $4.
What in, like, in hindsight, what was going on with this girl? Like, what were you trying to escape or to numb or what was happening here?
The reality that I was an alcoholic, I really wanted to numb that. Really did
With
not want to
alcohol.
ex yeah, with alcohol. I really did not want to accept that I could never drink. But if I was drunk, then I wasn't an alcohol because I couldn't alcoholic because I had no thoughts in my brain going on whatsoever.
How
So
scary. Were you scared?
no, I really wasn't. I had no idea what DTs meant, that you could even die from detoxing alone from alcohol. I had no idea the impact it had on your body.
No one told
And
you this?
no,
Wow.
I'm sure bits and pieces, but I don't think I ever saw it. And it wasn't until I was properly absorbing AA and I heard stories and I've seen people die from alcoholism now. And you see it, and it's horrible, and it's painful, and it's slow. And the body just eats itself, basically, or just starts rotting. And
Wow.
I never thought it would happen to me. I'm sure people can relate to that. You don't think it's going to be you. So,
I don't know if you can relate to this, but one of my best friends, Lyndall Hunt, she's been on the podcast quite a few times. She's in AA. She's done my course as well and worked with me also. But she said that when she was in the grips of it, and similar to yours, like that extreme level, that she actually got to the point where she thought, this is going to kill me, but I don't care.
I don't think for me, I'm sure if I continued, oh no, when I was drinking, I'd hoped that I would die. Yes.
Wow, fuck.
I don't think.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So you've woken up in hospital, they've had to resuscitate you.
Yeah. And I go back to Wesley and I enter back in there. And again, I suddenly felt relief. Finally, okay. We do this 4 weeks. We get this over with. We start afresh again. I kept thinking that it was just going to be like, here's a clean slate. And I got to the end of those 4 weeks and I really didn't want to leave. I got really scared about going to the outside world because I'd seen and I can't trust myself. I was like, frick, it's everywhere. I am so able to get it and I just don't trust myself. And so I kind of knew how to speak to therapists and especially to ones in hospital, been a few stays in different places, eating and stuff. So I knew how to extend my stay basically and stayed there. But it got to the beginning of the 7th week and they're like, you need to go now, need to like rotate the next lot in. So I left and I was feeling I was the same as when I left before. Again, I hadn't accepted I was an alcoholic. Deep down, I really just didn't want to. It just terrified me, the idea that I'd have to have my own wedding, something that girls have dreamed of, and like men, everyone, or certain people. And the romantic side of it is to have a glass of champagne or go to France and drink red wine with a baguette and cheese and those things, those pairings together of things. I was like, I won't be able to take part in them. And it's sad. It was really sad because I certainly didn't expect that to be my life. It's an accepted drink in society. It's part of highs and lows, and majority of people are able to just have one or two drinks. And I was like, how dare I be one of those people that can't?
And there you are on the outer again.
Yeah. And it was horrible. And I went to such a wonderful AA in the Central Coast in a place, Umina. And these people were so accepting. You know, I'd walked in and out of those rooms and I kept coming back, and they were like, just keep coming back. And there was a guy there called Doug who would say, just keep coming back till the miracle happens. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, where is this miracle? Now I know what that miracle is. That miracle is that you want to keep going to AA.
Yeah.
So now I've second rehab, been sober a bit, and COVID has started to be talked about, and airports are starting to shut, and I want to get to Joe in Africa. So books a flight and I leave for Africa on the 24th of March 2020, and I was probably about just a handful of people at the airport. It was really weird. And I remember when I was checking in and the girl at the counter was like, why are you leaving? And why are you going out of all places to Africa? Like to Zimbabwe. And I was like, to be with my love. Anyway, I obviously drink quite a bit, get quite drunk on the plane because drank my duty free. And then I arrive in Singapore. I'm there, stay over, I think, for 6 hours. And I'm really hungry. And I have no money because the money that Joe had given me was meant to be for food. So I ate things off people's plates that they'd left in the food court. And I know. And, you know, sometimes when I see those plates, and I remember walking through Changi Airport about a year ago, and I saw, like, people had, like, left your tray and you'd walk off. And I was like, oh. Anyway, so I get on the plane and we arrive in Zimbabwe. Oh gosh, I feel like I completely forgot the other time that I visited Africa, and that was the whole Chad experience. So anyway, I'm arriving in Africa and I'd sobered up a bit, but I was very shaky. And Joe picks me up at the airport and we go back.
Did he know
that I'd been drinking? I would say a little bit so, but he's pretty pissed off at me by now. Prior to that, I'd been in Africa visiting him once, and that's just a long drunk lot of, yeah. He's mad at me by now. I'm not holding up my end of the deal, I suppose. Like,
I don't understand Joe's psychology either.
I know.
I'm thinking, this guy, you put him in jail. You know, you're charged with domestic violence. Like,
yeah.
I mean, obviously he loves you, but where's his love for himself?
I know. Well, some people say to stay with someone who drinks as heavily as I did, or to stay with an alcoholic, you have to at some point have a warped idea of drinking. Like, your drinking is probably not healthy either. I mean, why on earth would you stay with me? Bits of it are like, is he staying with me because I'm always the scapegoat? And now that I've been sober for some time, a lot of his reality is hitting him. And it's no longer Fenella's fault. It's the light's on Joe, and he hates it. And he's squirming a bit with it all being focused on him.
That's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so he's picked you up. He's a bit pissed off.
But we settle into life. I'm there for about a month, and alcohol is dirt cheap in Zimbabwe. It's not very nice, but it was very accessible. And I was drinking. And about 4 weeks, about a month, I ended up in a rehab there. And those were like, this is not first world rehab, not even second world rehabs. This was, you have a big dormitory of about 14 people, you're all sleeping on these just mattresses, and you're given sort of a blanket. And I woke up, my first night I woke up and I was covered in ants, like not talking like 20 or something, I mean like thousands. Like, there was more ants on me than there was blanket. Like, I was just black in ants. And they sedate you most of the time that you're there. But I felt safe. But I was in a very weird, I was the only white girl there and felt a little bit out of place because of people obviously looking at you like, what on earth do you have to be drinking about? Look at your life. Like, and you hear some stories and you see, you get treated, you get two meals a day. Very, very simple. You do your own washing. There's no washing machine. You do your own washing by hand. So I'm there for a bit. Again, they just medicated you the whole time and I chuck out. So by now I'm sort of like on the rehab wheel. But I met a friend in that rehab. So I got myself a nice drinking buddy on the outside in Zimbabwe. And
so it didn't work.
And now COVID is starting to really close in. And I get put back into that rehab. And this place, I mean, Borodel Halfway House in Zimbabwe is nasty. And I end up back there. People are like, what on earth? Are you like, girl, get it. But this time, Joe hands me my passport, a bag of clothes, and he says, I'm done. My parents have sent me an email and have said, I'm done. We're done. I still can't read the message that my mom sent me because it's absolutely done with you. And I'm stuck now there with no money. I can't leave the country because of COVID. Everything's shut down. And I can't even kill myself because I'm stuck in this rehab, which is about four rooms and just people all around. You have no access to anything unless I'm going to hold my breath. They're just surrounded by people. So I can't, do anything. And there's an AA book there. And I open the AA book and there's a number for a woman. And I'd met this woman when I'd sort of first arrived in Zimbabwe because the person that we're actually staying with and we end up living with in Zimbabwe, her son had been in AA and has been in AA for about 15 years. So she was very aware of alcoholism and sort of knew when I was coming, what she was in for, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I'd met this woman and Anika and I message her and I say, I think it was along the lines of help. And 12 hours later, a guy called Paul Nobes turns up to the rehab. We chat and he said, okay, I'm going to take you up. We're going into the bush. And I go with him. I have no idea who this guy is. He's just some like 60-year-old man. But I have nothing. But I have this thing that people keep telling me about, this AA. And, you know, I'd been in it and heard it. And I was like, well, freaking have nothing else to do but this. So we go off, we drive about 4 hours out into the bush and we end up at this little house. And the moment they open the door, these two massive pit bulls jump on me and I'm like, great, going to be eaten alive by these pit bulls. And get out of the car and it's a little house with a little shack next to it. And a woman comes out and two other people. And these two other people are the people I'm going to be with for 3 months. And there's no Wi-Fi. There's Wi-Fi if you go stand on a rock on the sort of side. There's no TV. There's no books. There's no heating. There's no hot water unless you light a fire, which you need wood for, which needs to be dry. And this is like the beginning of, or sort of the end of Zimbabwe winter, which is very similar to a Sydney winter. It's very, very wet. And it's cold. It's about 16 down to maybe about 10 at night. But I didn't have any warm clothes and I'm there for 3 months and it was horrible. The first 2 weeks was the slowest ever. And these people were mean and tough. It's called Rhapsody. Sorry, they had started this rehab themselves. Just two alcoholics. There's no sort of bureaucracy or whatever in Zimbabwe. So they were able to open this up. And I was the second female they'd ever had. And any story that I'd started to tell about anything was just shut down. I was leveled to the ground, just incinerated by these guys.
They're like tough love kind of thing.
Oh, but like, you know, like I said before, you know, all I wanted was a hug and stuff like that. So the idea that this tough love was going to work, I have no explanation apart from what they say in AA, which was, it was spiritual awakening for me, where I took this tough love. And, but everything that I was trying to get away with, they knew better because they knew this disease. They knew it inside and out.
Give me an example, can you, of something like that you tried and then they would just level you?
So I was saying, you know, I think it was something along the lines of, oh, but it's been really tough for me growing up. And it's like, you grew up in the first world country. You are a selfish woman. And your looks will fade and then you will have nothing. And I was like, oh my God. It was then that I realized that I couldn't. And now I look at it, weasel my way out of saying anything. There was no, absolutely no blame on anyone else you were allowed to put on other than yourself. You could not blame your upbringing. You could not blame your circumstances. None of that. It didn't matter because clearly it shows that you can be in a third world, first world, second world. It doesn't matter. The core part of it and the core recovery is still the same. So I was called selfish nonstop. And I couldn't understand because I was like, but I'm, you know, not a mean person. And they're like, you are. Do you know what you've done to your family? Do you know what you've put them through? Do you know the pain that your parents have to be through? And I never had thought about it because I'd always thought about myself. I'd always said, oh, the alcoholism is happening to me. I'd never looked at it on the outside about the effect that it had on my parents.
I've got to say, this is challenging for me to hear because it goes against it, like, yeah, everything, like how I work, what I've been, you know, trained in. It's just so opposite. And I get it. I'm actually quite in awe. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And look, I've certainly had situations where I've wanted to lay level a few people and say, come on, get over yourself. But I guess they're trying to dig in deeper and find out. So yeah, this is, it's hard for me to hear and listen. I just want to, like, wow. But it worked, right?
It worked. And so this is just what worked for me.
And it's, you know, what worked for you. And maybe that's, I guess we try different things and clearly it wasn't working. It wasn't working for you before. Maybe you just, and I, look, at some point, like I've talked on the podcast before in my challenges, people I work with about taking responsibility, about not blaming others. And it's, the work has to be done on ourselves, never anyone else. I guess that's similar.
Yeah. But like you said, I think I had to go through so much of it because by now I'm ready to hear the message, which is you're an alcoholic. And I was ready to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
I lost everything. And there was no amount of, like, sort of, I wasn't shocked by what they were telling me. I didn't at all feel like, oh, I'm just going to leave you or I'm just going to run away. There was no place to run away to. I'd get eaten by a lion. Yeah. Like literally.
Yeah, literally, yeah, because, bloody hell.
There wasn't no one going to pick me up, and I accepted it, and I wanted what they had. I know that people say this in the room, you know, you need to look at people and see, and you want what they have, and I had gotten to the point where I was like, I just want peace. I want this obsession, this merry-go-round. I want to get off, and I did, and I got off, and the obsession, it says in the big book, will leave. And for me, it did. It left. I was there for 3 months. Getting in the second month, I was like, holy shit, I have 60 more days of this. There was nothing to do but to sort of talk to another guy there who was in his 60s and another girl coming off cocaine who was convinced that eating salt was going to solve her problems. Anywho, I leave there. Well, I get to the day where I'm checking out, which is actually the day that a year later that my son is born.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so I leave on the 27th of October and Joe doesn't really want anything to do with me, but I have to go somewhere because by now my family, I've tried my amends with my parents, but why on earth would this place in Zimbabwe that's not certified or there's no doctors or anything there, there's just these two random alcoholics drilling a big book into me, why on earth would this work compared to everything else? So everyone's very wary, but the people who were drilling, doing the drilling, told me that's fine. Let them heal. You've healed or you're healing. Let them do it in their own time. Just focus on you and your healing. They'll come around. You need to give them time. And that was something, because I really wanted it to be on my time. I wanted them to know how wonderful I was now and all of that sort of thing. And Joe went away for a fishing trip for about 10 days and I hadn't seen him for 3 months, and I thought he'd be really excited to see me, and he wasn't. Certainly wasn't trusted with money, so he just left enough food for me to get through those 10 days. And I walked to AA meetings, which in Zimbabwe was tough. It was, you know, I managed to get lifts back at night, and when people realized I was walking to the meetings, I got lifts. And I got an amazing sponsor, and she was a little bit older than me, but also incredibly tough. And yeah,
it's really, really interesting that, so just for the record for people listening, you've stayed sober since then.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what do you think it was? Was it just that tough love? What was the point? I mean, like you said, you were ready. Like, you were also very ready to,
yeah.
And I believe that when we're ready, we're ready.
Exactly. And that's what I believe. It is strange when you say, well, was it the tough love? It wasn't, but I think I had just surrendered. I'd given up now. Nope, I'm over it. It's just too much. And I just happened to have that moment when I was around other alcoholics who were there to help put the pieces back together again. Because that's something I personally really believe. I think that only an alcoholic or somebody who's gone through that can help another alcoholic.
Yeah,
you can't possibly be taught the pain and obsession that goes on in your brain. You can watch people, and I mean, my parents watched me. They're academics, so the idea that this was happening was very confusing, especially the idea that I would believe in a higher power. They were like, what? but I do, and for me, it's filled a hole that I've had since that my sister's birthday all those years ago. And now I have for me a way to live, a way to manage emotions. The drink is definitely taken away, but you certainly can't do life. I think I never knew how to deal with circumstances, you know, especially if things don't go my way, how to accept that this is life.
What I'm hearing for you is there's been acceptance. There was acceptance when you accepted that this has got me by the balls. And also now, like, just accepting things for how they are rather than get, I think acceptance helps so much because it stops us getting into our head and fighting against the reality or fighting against what is.
Yeah. And I didn't question it. I don't, you know, people do ask me, they're like, so what was the spiritual experience like? What's your higher power like? All these, I don't really look too much into it apart from that it's there. I don't overanalyze it, because the moment I'm doing that, you can find faults. You can find anything to prove against it or prove this and that. And until, if you just believe it, don't push it. It is what it is.
Have you ever had any moments that the thinking has started where, oh, you just have one or just try it or?
No.
That's good.
And my partner still drinks. There's alcohol in the house. My parents still, I mean, my parents were never big drinkers, and my mom, she's terrified now of alcohol. She hates it. She absolutely hates it because she'd never seen what it can do. And she thinks it's just pure poison. Absolutely hates it. But my partner, Joe's still a very heavy drinker. So when I got out, those first 6 months of being in the real world, or being outside of a contained space of sobriety, was the hardest. And that first Christmas was so awful. And there was a moment where I thought at that Christmas, how can I do this? And I sat there, and Joe had this philosophy and still does, you know, alcoholism is your problem, not mine, which probably is a whole nother can of worms, but we'll just keep to this one. So I was completely exposed to the alcohol, and I didn't really want to drink it, but I didn't know how to socialize anymore. How on earth do you go and talk to people and like be interested in what they're talking about? Like, it's not. And you're also in such a slump because your dopamine has been so demolished by alcohol for so long, that the things that would normally give you a high, things that give me a high now, I didn't have back in those first 6 months of sobriety. I did not get happy over like buying something nice for myself, or I didn't have anything that reached the happiness that alcohol gave you. So my life was really like all brand cereal. It was just getting by.
Good on you for sticking at it, because
bland as.
Yeah, but to be able to go, yeah, life is really bland, and to imagine how that felt, knowing that you could have grabbed one of those drinks, but you didn't. And I think that's just so, like, what a courageous and, like, yeah, amazing.
A lot of it was down. I didn't want to prove. I was pretty scared of the people who what we call 12-stepped me. And I really, really didn't want to tell them that I'd relapsed. I really wanted to show them that I could do it. And, yeah, so I got through that first Christmas, that first New Year. And then we found out about 2 months later that I was pregnant. And we'd been trying for a child on and off. And, well, we weren't trying like, oh, my gosh, we have to get pregnant this month. But it would be nice to have a baby. What we were thinking, bringing a baby into an alcoholic household of me, and I certainly wasn't capable. And my body was not allowing it, thank God. But it just proved how healthy I was, and I fell pregnant naturally. I have polycystic ovaries and endometriosis, so falling pregnant was always going to be a bit difficult. And I just out of the blue fell pregnant. I had a healthy pregnancy. I managed to do the, I flew back to Australia to give birth during COVID, and I did the 2 weeks in quarantine, which I was nervous about. I mean, I'd heard it's a very taxing on your mental health being stuck in one of those hotel rooms.
Did you get the mini bar cleared out?
They didn't give you one.
Oh, good.
They get their alcohol was, I mean, I think you were allowed like two bottles in, but I'm sure like as an alcoholic, I would have found a way, and I probably would have died in that hotel room 100%. And anyone who was suffering immensely, or like anyone suffering mental health going in, actually even people, it's just a nasty place to be. But I got through it. I got through it. I had a great sponsor. I was able to talk through it. Plus, I think coming from like Africa, coming from there, going into a first world hotel felt like a dream. There was hot water. There was internet. The food was fantastic. I mean, people were like complaining about all these things that I was like, whoa, you have them. They're so amazing. So I think that helped, because that was just the novelty of the whole thing being back in the first world. And then I left. I remember my dad picked me up, and the last thing he had seen of me was getting on a plane to Zimbabwe thinking I'm coming back in a box dead. And I'd walked out of that quarantine heavily pregnant, and he just burst into tears. And he's just crying and just hugging me, and it's just like, I'm alive, I'm happy. But like for the first time, like I'm actually genuinely happy, in the sense that like I can take bad and good with life, and to me that feels happy. I'm no longer trying to numb anything, and weirdly enough, that for me is happy.
Yeah,
because the numbing is yeah, it's a whole nother planet, and I don't like that planet.
Yeah, and it's not necessary, is it? Once you realize you can go through those things, you realize, wow, the numbing.
But you realize, yeah, you can go through them, but nothing stays the same for very long, the good or the bad. And it goes up and down, and everybody has those ups and downs. That's what the great thing that I love about AA is, that you realize you're not the only one having a shit week, or not the only one not being able to deal with certain things. Because it is really hard now. You know, I get in that whole looking at Instagram every evening and being like, oh, Jesus, how much money do they have? They're on holiday with their kid. Joe, we don't go on any holidays with Freddie. Like, and you compare and you get envious and all that sorts of things. And they're dangerous slippery slopes. So especially for an alcoholic.
Especially if that's been part of your core wounding and part of the trigger.
Absolutely, yeah. So now,
what do you do when that shows up?
I do a lot of readings. I read, we do like those daily readings for AA, and they're not very long, but there's always something in that message. And it just reminds me that it's fear, and I'm not accepting certain situations, blah, 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 but that if I hand it over to God, it'll be okay. And it sounds so weird, I know, because I remember listening to people saying, hand it over to God, what a load of crock of shit. But I do. I don't know what it is I'm handing over to. I don't hold it. It's just not on me anymore. And life will be life. And I look at things that have happened now, like I never thought that I would have Freddie and never thought I would be with Joe still. And life miracle. Is, yeah.
Waiting for a miracle. It's like you got it.
Yeah, I did.
And life will be life. That is so true. What a great slogan. Life will be life. And yeah, you've just got to give it over sometimes. And whilst I don't subscribe to that, kind of like I don't give it over to God, but in a way I do, like I do give things over to a higher power. I believe there's definitely a higher power. I tune in with it all the time when I'm meditating. And when something's bothering me, it's probably exactly the same thing. It just happens, you know, in meditation. Yeah. I don't name it that, but I really think it's an essential part of our spiritual growth and our growth on this journey. When we've taken something as big as alcohol out and you need to replace it with something bigger, talk about that a lot, but to tap more into that spirituality so that we can accept things, so that we can give things over, so we can let things go and trust.
Yeah, absolutely. And know that you're not alone.
And we're not alone,
And it's just, it's progress. That was something that I love as well, is it's progress, not perfection. You don't have to get it right. You can have those emotional outbursts, but it's, you know, how you deal with it after. Live in the solution, not the problem, all those sorts of things. Just keep moving forward.
And what you learn from it too. Like anytime there's been an emotional outburst or something's really got you by the balls, it's always later where you sit and reflect and journal on it. What is this trying to, what did this teach me? Yeah. What was this showing me? That's where the learning happens. And that's why it's worth it. It's worth having gone through that. And that's why it's good not to be perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Mm. Exactly. And it's, you're human.
No. Yeah.
You can be really tough on yourself and just have a little bit of compassion and know that there are coping mechanisms and people are just like you out there.
Do you feel like you've found peace now? You seem very peaceful.
Yeah. I have my moments where we're back at the moment living with my parents while Joe sorts out his job in Australia. And it's tough. And I get these flare-up moments where I really want attention from my parents, mostly because I want to prove to them that I'm doing really good. Not so much attention like when I was younger, like a hug or something like that. It more sort of just like a weird praise. But then if, strangely enough, if I sometimes do get it, it's never up to my standards anyway. So it's never met properly. So like doing AA, the only person I need to really worry or think about is just my higher power. And that's helped me no longer put my mental happiness or my mental state on other people. It's not dependent on how Joe's feeling, how Freddie's feeling, how my parents are feeling. It's just,
I think it's so, so important. Oh, Fenella, I could just talk, like this is probably one of the longest podcasts I've
done.
No, it's great. I could keep talking and I'd probably love to get you back on because there's more things I'd love to talk about and dissect. But looking back, would you change any of your story?
Absolutely not. Everything had a place. And it sounds awful because, you know, to this day, we still live with that domestic violence. It's been expunged or whatever, but it's still there. It still pops up some places, especially on visas and all that sort of thing.
Well, Joe couldn't come into Australia for quite a while.
He couldn't come in. No, he couldn't come into Australia. It was only this year that his visa was granted.
Because of that domestic violence.
He missed the birth of his son. A lot of that had to do, obviously, with COVID and all of that thing. That one was more linked to COVID, but he certainly couldn't come back before that. Sorry, it didn't really stop him. It just something that they asked a lot of questions about.
It was difficult.
It was difficult. He had to prove a lot. He had to get a fresh police statement and all that sort of stuff to say it no longer exists and he's got a clean record.
If you could go back and speak to young teenage Fenella, what would you say to her? What advice would you give her?
Stop caring about what others think. Stop putting your outside more important than your inside. Like, I just thought that if I changed my body, if I changed where I lived, if I changed a partner, if I numbed everything, and maybe get some therapy.
100%.
Start now.
Look, there was something that you and I were talking about on my couch the other day. I was talking about what you'd been through as a teenager with an eating disorder. And, it comes up a fair bit in my work, whether someone's either had an eating disorder or dealing with kids that have eating disorders. What would you say to a parent whose child is struggling with an eating disorder? Is there any kind of advice you might give them or something that might help them? What might you have needed at that time when you were when it first started, or when you were having a flare up?
Love, I think just it's really hard because it's from now I see the pain that I put my parents through. But I think I would say compassion, but I think a lot of parents out there are scared. You just want to fix it, you just want it to go away.
The other thing is, when parents are going through things like that, obviously their wounding comes up of I'm not good enough and
Yeah.
I'm not a good enough parent.
That is just, yeah, please don't blame yourself. You know, I certainly, obviously I got some diet tips from my mom and she's not the greatest, healthiest eater, but there's no one to blame. Please don't blame yourself.
Don't blame yourself, and also realizing when if you are feeling angry about it or if you're feeling desperate about it. I think what you said there, probably what the child just needs is love. They probably just want to be wrapped up and
Yeah.
loved, even though they might be pushing you away.
Yeah.
I've experienced that with my own
Absolutely.
daughter when,
Yeah.
I've tried to reach out and she's pushed me away, and that hits me. That hits my stuff. But
Yeah.
you've got to not react and just keep
Yeah.
on pushing through with the love.
Also something, it's usually the eating disorder is but a symptom of something else. So the eating disorder is not, what a lot of people usually think. It's, oh, they were doing it for attention. It might have started off along those lines, but at some point there was a trigger to have put it taken it to such an extreme that it was something else going on. So it's not just because, they wanted to be the most beautiful girl in the room. Obviously there's a part of it there, or the most successful person or whatever, but there's something deeper down. There's always something deeper down.
It's but a symptom, just like alcohol.
Yeah, it
Yeah, it's but a
is.
symptom. Yeah. And interesting what you said earlier, and that was such a great perspective that it was taking away the anxiety. It was, yeah, so
Oh.
really great conversation to have. I hope this hasn't triggered anyone, this conversation, or any parents in particular, but it's good to have conversations. This is how we get messages out. This is how we learn, and
Absolutely.
hopefully what you've shared today is, it's pretty
Yeah.
extreme, but
Yeah.
it's also a testament, Finella, that you can be so extreme and so off the rails and keep on going back, and it's not working, it's not
Yeah,
working,
yeah.
it's not working, and then something clicks. So there's always hope.
There's hope. Everybody else had sort of lost hope around me, and but you're so tunnel visioned, and you, but yeah, don't lose hope. And there's not a sort of a right fit for everybody as well. I think a lot of people think, well, if this worked for such and such, it's got to work for you. There's
Percent.
loads of different. I'm not saying that AA is the only way to get sober.
Yeah.
Either. The most important thing is what was working for you.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's right. And sometimes you just got to try the same thing multiple times, or if it's just not working, you go and try something else and until
Yeah.
something works. And that's what it's
Yeah.
at the end of the day, you've just got to get well. It doesn't matter how you do it. Yeah.
And while I remember, I just suddenly popped into my mind. The guy who 12-stepped me, he wrote a book about his recovery and he explains the 12 steps, but he doesn't use it in a higher power. He uses the animals and the wildlife of Africa
Oh,
to
wow. Do you
explain
know the
it.
name of the book?
Spirit on Fire. And it's a beautiful story. It's about he goes into the bush and he gets in touch with nature and is stripped from everything.
Wow. Spirit on Fire. Okay, I'll put that in the show notes as well so people can
It's
look that up.
also
Wonderful.
handy because my parents read it, and for them, my mum said it was the only thing that she's ever read that she under then she understood alcoholism. She understood the 12 steps. She understood a lot more, because it was the big book is dated in a lot of its language. It's hard for people who are non-alcoholic to understand exactly what it is, or if you haven't got a sponsor taking you through it, such and such. But yeah, she found this book.
What was his name, Fenella?
Paul Nobes.
Paul Nobes. Okay.
Spelt Nobes.
Amazing. Thank you so much. All right, so I'll put that into the show notes. Thank you.
Thank you so for taking your time.
No, thank you for sharing your story and just for being so vulnerable and honest. Like, that's what I love interviewing AA people, because they are so honest. It's so great because they're so used to sharing their story, I think. But thank you so, so much. And I think it's such a big, powerful story, and you should write your own book one day.
Oh, no, thank you. And please, if anyone is listening from Singapore, please don't arrest me for those unpaid hospital bills.
Or that unpaid minibar.
Oh, oof. Anywho, but thank you so much, Danny. I really appreciated having this chat. That's cool.
Amazing. What a story. What a story. And so much hope in that story. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Just don't give up. Just don't do give up. Not give up. Whatever state you are in.
Yeah.
You know, you might think that there is absolutely no hope. Yes, there is. And it will come in the strangest of forms. But there is hope.
Amazing.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.